Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Blood, Sweat, and Strife, the best podcast in the Horsehead Nebula. I am Mason, and my pronouns are she, they.
And I'm Isabel. My pronouns are she, her.
I'm Jeremy. My pronouns are he, him.
And today we have a guest. Her name is Cheryl Weichel. She is a name-your-own-price anti-poverty lawyer who works with people who are facing evictions, people who are facing charges against them for other crimes of poverty, and disabled people. She's fighting the good fight, and we wanted to highlight her in today's episode.
Thank you so much for having me. I am indeed Cheryl Weichel, and I am indeed a lawyer, or at least they told me that when I graduated law school. And my pronouns are she, her.
Very cool, very cool. So, how are you doing today?
I am great. Thank you so much for having me. I am really very honored to be here.
Yeah, we're honored to have you.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah.
It's actually kind of funny. My girlfriend just happened to look up at the screen and see the name of who we're interviewing and got really excited. She follows you on Blue Sky as well.
Ah, that's so cool.
Okay, now I'm very honored and probably blushing. So,
Yeah, that's awesome. Tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do.
So I am what I call a name your own price lawyer, which is to say that in 42 states, Illinois is one of them, the public defender is not free. And what that means is most people assume that when they are charged with a crime, they get the public defender who defends them for free. Not necessarily. First, you have to qualify for the public defender. And if you don't, then you can either have to represent yourself or pay the public defender. And even if you do, you end up having to pay the public defender at the end of the case, depending on what kind of case it is and costs and hours worked. You have to reimburse the public defender. Irony being that the public defender fees that you're paying don't go to the public defender's office, but we can get into that later. And there is no public defender for things like eviction, foreclosure, family court. So you end up with this weird situation where you can have your liberty or your housing or your family taken away from you without any representation whatsoever. So I run what I call a name your own price practice, which means my clients tell me what they can afford, and that's the price. And I don't charge hourly. All of my clients pick whatever they pay. Sometimes they're paying upfront, sometimes they're paying per month, but I have clients who pay $20 a month. I have clients who pay a few hundred bucks a month. I work just as hard for everybody. And my goal is to make sure that everybody has an attorney, because in this system, representation is a human right. So I go to all of Illinois' 102 counties, and Illinois is a pretty decently sized state. So end up doing a lot of driving. Because there are very few courthouses in the state accessible by public transportation. So I do a lot of driving. I've put 30,000 miles on my car since March. So I'm doing this particular type of law for almost 3 years now. And I started it when I was the legal director at a legal aid clinic, where we were providing free representation to people facing eviction. And the clinic closed during the pandemic. And one of the things that I hated was my choices were essentially to hang my clients out to dry or hang out a shingle and see and keep their cases. Because when the clinic closed, it's not like they could walk into court and say, sorry, our legal clinic closed. They were still facing eviction during the pandemic. And the idea that there was an eviction moratorium, I mean, landlords kept trying to get around it anyway. And we're letting them. So I decided with a very, very understanding wife, who at the time, she and I had just moved in together, and she was incredibly understanding about it, because I actually had an offer for a partner level position at a law firm on the East Coast. My wife looked at me and said, I guess you could represent old white people, but that's probably not where your heart is. And she's just amazing and incredibly understanding, because you're never going to make any money doing name your own price lawyering. But she was used to it because she would never make any money doing legal aid work either. So I owe everything to her. She's just amazing. And that's how this started. I went from consumer law to legal aid to doing this. So I've always been on this side of the proverbial V. And then I expanded into criminal work about a year and a half ago when there was just so much demand for it. People were telling me, well, you represented me in my eviction. I can't afford the public defender. Can you handle this stuff as well? And given the demand and the need for those services, I decided to expand it into criminal also.
Hmm. That's really a very interesting and like cool story. It seems like you genuinely want to help people by doing what you do, because like you could go and make a bunch of money representing people who are scumbags, but you chose to represent people who genuinely need your help and deserve fair legal representation.
You know, I do this work because I genuinely believe it is my purpose. Not necessarily the name your own price model, but being on this side. I felt the same way about when I worked at Legal Aid, and I was devastated when that clinic closed because we were representing people for free. And if I had the ability, I would represent people for free now. I just, you know, kind of need to support yourself, unfortunately. The nature of this work is that you try to make sure that everybody who needs a lawyer can get a lawyer, because I genuinely believe that in this system, representation is a human right. One of the most destructive tendencies I've seen is this idea that you don't need a lawyer in court, that if you just have the facts on your side, you'll win. It does not work that way. And I wish I could say I love my work. I love my clients. My clients are awesome. They are the real heroes because they are facing some absolutely awful stuff. I don't know if I am allowed to use profanity on here. It is just.
Oh, you're allowed.
Yeah, they face a lot of fucked up shit. Pardon my language. It generally with grace and dignity, and they're just fantastic people. I love my clients. I hate the work, but I'm doing what I was meant to do. And I don't think I could live with myself using the license for any other purpose. There are already plenty of lawyers who are representing landlords, state, and getting plenty of money off of it. My job is to make sure that the people that they are trying to take advantage of have a shot. And I cannot sit here and say that we win every time, because there's an old saying, show me a lawyer who's never lost a case and I'll show you a lawyer who's never tried a case. But I'm fortunate that we've been able to win more than we've lost. And given what's at stake, that's a really good feeling.
That's fantastic.
That's actually really amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. I have kind of a silly question, if that's okay.
Absolutely.
So when I picture these like legal teams who are like representing landlords, I always picture Mr. Burns's legal team from The Simpsons. Is this an accurate stereotype?
Well, it depends on the case. I've been up against some really weird lawyers. One of the things that I noticed, because I've been a lawyer for almost 11 years now, and which is terrifying because it feels like I graduated law school yesterday, but I got out of law school and I've been representing tenants pretty much nonstop ever since. First as a consumer lawyer and then legal aid, and now as a part of a name your own price practice. And the thing that I've observed is that landlord lawyers tend to fall into one of two camps. There are the landlords who are not used to any kind of opposition, where there is an expectation, and unfortunately there are tenant lawyers who play into this or along with this expectation, that you just do your part and move on. It's a very similar expectation the prosecutors have for certain defense attorneys. You're just supposed to get your client to plead guilty and move on. That's your job. I had a case against a landlord's lawyer who actually filed a motion for sanctions, which is a request that the judge punish me, because I filed a jury demand on behalf of my client. And the landlord's lawyer said, well, if he doesn't have any defenses, why is she making us have a trial when she has no defenses? And so I'm like, my client has a constitutional right to a trial. If my client wants a trial, my client's going to get a trial. It's not like you only get a jury trial under certain circumstances. We're entitled, as a matter of law, to hold you to your proof. We're not just going to roll over because you think that that is what we're supposed to do. And then we ended up having to litigate this entire thing. But I've been up against some very strange lawyers. There was a lawyer who was advertising their tea business in all of their motion papers, which was just very strange. There was
okay.
Yeah, that was
wow.
Yeah, every single filing, they compared the arguments to flavors of their tea. It was
holy shit!
Really peculiar.
That's really bizarre. I guess that was his real passion. Like,
I mean, they're a landlord's lawyer who evidently wanted to get into the tea business.
Yeah,
I never tried their tea. It was just weird. There was a case I had against one of the largest banks in the country, where their attorneys showed up to every hearing with an agenda, and this bank was represented by 9 different attorneys at every hearing, and the agenda, each of their attorneys would get a time to speak, and then they would designate a few minutes for me. And I'd be like, wait, so you're getting like an hour and I'm getting like 3 minutes. That doesn't seem, well, this is how we're going to do it. My favorite part was that one of these lawyers was making $1,400 an hour, which is how much some of these attorneys get paid. My favorite landlord attorney story, it was actually a law school classmate of mine who was really upset about something or other from when we had both been in the same classes in law school. And honestly, it sounds terrible, but I did not even remember this person. Law school classes tend to be big and stressful. I didn't even know. And it sounds terrible, but this person was just not memorable to me. In a hall of 100 people with assigned seating, you sit where you sit, and you know the people you know. My law school class was bigger than my college class, so I evidently they are out to prove they're a better lawyer than me. Okay, fine, whatever. And they spend the first year of litigation telling me, well, you never noticed me when I sat in the front row during professional ethics class, and I'm going to prove I'm a better lawyer than you. And okay. Whatever, that was 10 years ago. Can we please move on with our lives? You know. So eventually, they file a few things that are just unbelievably racist in terms of the arguments. Everything from Black people have a persecution complex to this suit is anti-white racism, et cetera, et cetera. So I filed the appropriate response to that motion. And then this person shows up to the next hearing wearing all of the bronzer. All of it. And a hairstyle that can only be described as unfortunate. And keep in mind that this person is as white as I am. And
oh, wow.
When they start talking, there is an unfortunate accent as well.
Oh, my God.
And that was the closest I've ever come in court to just breaking down. Because yeah. I was biting my lower lip to keep from laughing. I had my motion papers up in front of my face because I couldn't tell what was more ridiculous. This display or that, this lawyer, an equity partner at a major law firm, thought this was going to work. And the entire competition was just completely weird to me because this is somebody who makes 10 times what I do in a year. I've never done this for the money. I don't know why they're in a competition with me, because frankly, I'm not in a competition with any of the attorneys, any other attorneys, because I can't and do what I do, if that makes sense. You know, if you're going to judge by income, I'm going to lose. Okay, fine, whatever. If you're going to judge by the size of the cases, going to lose that too, because the average eviction is $300, filed over $300. I mean, I personally think that's bigger than your corporation versus corporation multi-million dollar lawsuits, but it is what it is. Anyway, so we're fighting over this, and this lawyer is wearing all the bronzer, has the very interesting braids and the very bad accent, and the judge looks at this lawyer and says, "What is going on?"
Oh God!
And the explanation was, I can't be racist. I'm a person of color. It was no one believed that. No one believed it. And
oh my God!
Wow!
But that is one of the things I've learned is that lawyers who represent landlords tend to be very surprised when there is anything more than token opposition, and tend often to be very unaccustomed to dealing with people who fight back. Because representation for tenants, for defendants in criminal cases who can't afford the public defender, for people going through foreclosure, for people facing discrimination, is so rare. And so a lot of my job is just to sort of throw a wrench in the works and slow things down. Just to make the other side spend more money. Because a lot of the, and I guess this goes back to your question about Lionel Hutz, a lot of the mechanics of the system depend on quick resolutions that are cheap for whoever is bringing the case. And my job is to make sure it's expensive. So a saying that I tell my wife all the time is, my job, win or lose, is to try and make every eviction the most expensive eviction this landlord ever does.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Not because I want to make them to light the money on fire, but because their entire business model for evictions is based on quick wins. Same thing with foreclosures. Yeah. Same thing with prosecutors. My job is to make sure that I maximize my leverage, and sometimes that's just slow things down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and like sort of more on like the macro level, like we all know that like the court system favors people who have money, people who own property. But like a case that I think about a lot is DuPont Chemicals. They spend decades poisoning communities and just poisoning normal people with their like Teflon products. And when litigation was finally like filed against them and there was a big court case, they just paid a few million dollars and then like moved on. So like oftentimes it's about like doing what is most expedient for this company, this landlord, whoever is on the end of this litigation.
I mean, I will push back a little bit, because DuPont did not just move on. They then began lobbying hard for changes to class action rule.
Wow.
So, and a reason I think that's important is there is a myth out there, and it is very much a myth, that Americans are incredibly litigious.
Mm-hmm.
Americans are not litigious at all. And if you look at these statistics, Americans file fewer lawsuits than most other countries. There is a reason for the myth, though. The myth is corporate propaganda. And let me explain why. As you are probably aware, the United States has some of the most underregulated industry in the world. And as a matter of policy, those decisions were made with the idea that the courts and access to them would provide for regulation where the government does not. We don't need to set regulations for this, because lawsuits will be filed if it's not, if it isn't correct, it'll be self-regulating in that way. And that was something that corporations pushed for.
Yeah.
Now, what's interesting about that is corporations at the same time were also pushing for increases to court costs. Court costs and filing fees are a huge source of revenue for states. But what's interesting is they're a terrible source of revenue for states, regardless of how much they charge, because so many people cannot afford to pay them. Take Cook County, for example. Let's say I want to file a lawsuit against DuPont Chemicals, for example, and I want a jury demand. It'll cost me $1,000 out of pocket in court costs. Not wow. for my attorney, mind you. I haven't paid my attorney. Just to file the case. That doesn't include if I want a court reporter. That doesn't include if I need an expert witness. That doesn't include anything that fees for any filings after the complaint. That doesn't include service of process. Just to file the complaint with a jury demand is close to $1,000. So what we have, and the argument behind that, that corporations have pushed for a while, is to clear congestion in the court system. So what we have really is a court system with an incredibly regressive gatekeeping tax system, filing fees, which is another reason why so many people come to me, because they can't afford both filing fees and an attorney.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, most people who are victimized by corporate abuses can't afford litigation to address them. That combined with the constant push for what is called in the media tort reform, or class action reform, or frivolous lawsuits, when in reality, that's just corporations who are upset that the courts occasionally will try to serve their purpose of regulation, which is what the purpose was supposed to be since we under-regulate them in every other way. And then they push back on that, and that leads to this myth of, well, we need to curtail lawsuits because there are so many greedy ambulance chasers. That's just not true. I don't know how much you know about the original McDonald's hot coffee case, but that is a great example of this.
I know. Yes. I know a little bit about the original McDonald's hot coffee case. I remember. Well, I think it was in the 90s, so that yes. was before I was born. But I know that like it was this huge like story for a little while, and a lot of people were like making jokes about it, and everybody was like, "Oh, this is ridiculous! They're suing McDonald's because their coffee was hot."
Yeah.
But in my understanding, there's. Like, they had a legitimate reason for being upset.
Yes, they did.
Yeah, she had to get skin grafts afterwards. Yeah. That's how badly she
McDonald's,
got
burned. But it wasn't just that she got skin grafts. McDonald's had deliberately put their coffee at or near the boiling point by corporate directive, because when people burned their tongues, they didn't order refills. And that allowed them to provide free refills without actually doing free refills.
Wow.
And at that store, there had been multiple burns in the preceding months that they refused to address. And so what the reason that McDonald's was hit with the judgment that they were hit with was because of the extent of this elderly woman's injuries, that she was going to have medical care for the rest of her life. And because McDonald's had the jury found a deliberate indifference to the safety of its own employees, and that deliberate indifference directly led to their deliberate indifference towards the safety of their customers.
Yeah.
Now, McDonald's then spent millions of dollars pushing the "she spilled hot coffee on herself and got $1 million" lie. And that led to a series of tort reform bills, in air quotes, mostly pushed by Republicans, that led to caps on punitive damages.
Mm-hmm.
And so the idea of the ambulance chasing lawyer in the United States is largely the result of propaganda from corporations to disparage attorneys who represent consumers against large corporations.
Yeah, I swear to God, I have a point when I bring this up, but like going back to like the Lionel Hutz analogy, there's an episode of The Simpsons from like, you know, like 1992, I think. I think it was like a season two episode where Bart gets run over by Mr. Burns's car. And he has to, like, get an ambulance, he has to get put in a cast, all that other stuff. And then Lionel Hutz is like, oh, I see dollar signs. So, like, even though, like, Bart wasn't really that injured, the whole episode is about them trying to get, like, basically just money out of Mr. Burns. And this fits in with that overarching, like, narrative of like propaganda that we were just talking about.
Yeah.
Like, this billionaire should get sued because he ran over a fucking kid. But the whole episode is like playing on like, oh, you know, these greedy working class Americans are just trying to like scam an honest billionaire out of a quick buck.
You know, the worst part about that propaganda is how effective it is.
It is.
Take Law and Order, for example. I call all of this copaganda, including stuff about civil lawsuits, because it all plays into the police for reasons I can get to in a minute. The worst part of it is how devastatingly effective it is across the political spectrum. I know too many liberals and leftists who believe copaganda even when they are aware of propaganda about the military-industrial complex or the institutional racism that is pervasive to this day across the American government, to the actual stories of the two genocides that founded this country. But when it comes to the courts, without even realizing it, they've been propagandized by that. Mm. And they view the courts not through what they are, but as, oh, this is how working class people become bourgeois or become greedy or American decadence. That, when in reality, for most working class Americans, the courts are their only way to redress any kind of redress at all. And most are priced out of it because the courts are very much a pay-to-play scheme. And the worst part of that is you don't get to decide when you interact with the legal system. We're good about health when we talk about healthcare, Medicare for all, because you cannot opt out of the healthcare system. Everyone is going to need healthcare at some point in their lives, right? So everyone should have healthcare. That makes sense. But when you say everyone should have representation, you get pushback, which is interesting because just like with healthcare, you cannot opt out of the legal system. You will get pulled over at some point during your life. You will get sued at some point during your life. If you have a landlord, you will get a termination notice at some point during your life. And that it's easy for people to say, well, it won't happen to me. But the average eviction filing in the United States is for less than $300. So, yeah. And because we have no cause eviction in this country, everyone who rents will get a termination notice at some point. Everyone who ever signs a contract will interact with the legal system in some way at some point. If you lease or buy a car, they will enforce that through the courts. If you buy a house, it will be enforced through the courts. If a relative dies and leaves you an inheritance, you have to go to court. If you have kids and you and your partner end up getting a divorce, or if you were never married and you need a custody agreement, that must go through the courts. It is impossible in the United States to live a full life without interacting with the legal system at least once. It is impossible. It cannot happen. And there is a huge, I think at least, there is a huge area that goes completely unaddressed in activism and advocacy, where we realize, number one, that the courts are a massive opportunity for harm reduction, and number two, that it has to be a focus for universal programs to help people because you cannot opt out of them. Because it is one of only two things in this country, the other being healthcare, where you have no choice in the matter. You will interact with it. It will drag you in against your will. It will charge you money for doing it. And you cannot stop it, because if If, for example, your landlord files an eviction case against you, you have to pay filing fees to go to court to defend yourself, and you can't just not. So yeah. the way the court system is handled is viewed in this country is the result of a multi-decade propaganda campaign by the police and by corporations, and it has worked beautifully. And that's the worst part of it, because very few people look at the courts and see the people who are victimized by it as what they are, which is good people getting hurt, and instead see way too much of what propaganda says they should.
Yeah. I think it's very funny and ironic that, like, it's so much easier for a landlord to evict somebody than it is for a working class person to have any sort of redress against that, because the landlord is using your rent to pay for the court fees to evict you. Like, right. It's a fucked up power dynamic. It really is. Yeah.
The system is so incredibly dystopian, like, just cutting just a little bit beneath the surface. It's incredibly dystopian. The imbalance of power between the impoverished and the wealthy is, in a lot of ways, at its starkest when we look at the legal system.
No, that's absolutely true. And the worst part is how, by design, that is. So, for example, take eviction statutes in the United States. They used to be called Forcible Entry and Detainer Act. And in some states, they still are. Originally, Forcible Entry and Detainer Acts were 14th century British laws that allowed for lords and earls to break into the houses of peasants and throw them out.
Oh, wow.
Now, the reason they were passed was, before these laws, the lord or earl would just send armed goons to go kill them. And the crown was like, well, if we keep allowing this to happen, eventually there will be no more peasants. So here's a procedure to follow to throw them out of the their houses. Because remember, the lord or earl owns the land, not the tenant. So that's where the term landlord actually comes from. Mm-hmm. Later, those laws in the 18th century were repurposed to allow for legal process to dispossess indigenous and native people from land, because it needs to be, quote unquote, legal. So is this allowed you to forcibly enter onto the land and detain it? It also included certain provisions about no counterclaims, just to make sure that the indigenous people couldn't sue you back. Now, it didn't come into residential evictions until, and this is true, 1866, year after the Civil War ended. Surprise, surprise. Slavery is now abolished, and the state of Oregon passes a forcible entry and detainer law specifically targeted to allow for white people to dispossess black tenants.
Hmm.
In 1972, that law went to the Supreme Court by a group of tenants challenging its constitutionality. And they were challenging its constitutionality by pointing out that essentially it allowed for no-cause evictions by landlords, and that the tenants were not allowed to countersue under this law, so only the landlord's claims got heard. And this was right after the end of the Warren Court. Now, the Warren Court was the time that the Supreme Court was run by a justice by the name of Earl Warren. He was Chief Justice, and it was his court, because he was the most influential justice on it, for about 15 years. And he was responsible for everything from Brown v. Board of Education, which ended school segregation, to Brady versus Maryland, which said you actually cannot hide evidence that shows innocence from the defense in a criminal case, to Miranda versus Arizona, which is your rights must be read to you, to Loving versus Virginia, which was interracial marriage is legal across the United States. The what rights we think of as the result of the Civil Rights Act were the result of a lot of very dedicated organizers and activists and the Warren Court responding to them. Most of these rights do not come from Congress, but come from the Warren Court in a 15-year period. And they did more to advance the cause of civil rights in that 15-year period than was that happened before or since. And the Federalist Society was actually formed in direct response to the Warren Court. But after Earl Warren retired due to health reasons, the court tacked hard right and began undoing a lot of what he had done. And so in 1972, in a case called Lindsay versus Normette, the U.S. Supreme Court held that there is no right to housing in the United States, that there is no right to a counterclaim against your landlord in the United States, and it is not unconstitutional to have an eviction system with disproportionate impacts on marginalized people or the poor, because the reasoning in the decision is just this plain, because if the United States were to grant a right to housing, it would then have to give a right to health care and a right to education and a right to food, and we aren't going to do that. And then worse,
that's so gross.
And then worse, the decision goes on to say that the United States is a system of private property, and the most important thing is the landlord's right to get their money as quickly as possible.
Yeah, sounds about right.
Now, yeah,
I mean, shows where our priorities are right there.
And because of that case, that case is why the eviction system is the way it is. Because in that case, it was a direct challenge to those eviction statutes on the basis that after Brown v. Board, this was a de facto segregation law. And Thurgood Marshall, in his dissent, wrote as much. And there was no dispute about that. But the response from the majority in Lindsay versus Normette was, actually, some segregation is okay. And then the year after that, in a case called San Antonio School District, the U.S. Supreme Court held that there is no right to an education, and essentially limited Brown v. Board to its facts. And when they did that, they essentially killed any future progress in terms of both multiracial democracy and any kind of right to equality in American institutions.
Wow.
So the really fucked up part about how much there is inequality and wealth inequality in the court system, going into education, going into housing, is that Lindsay and San Antonio were explicit that this is a deliberate choice we are making. There is a belief that the legal system is broken and that it prioritizes the wealthy by effect. That is simply not true. If you look at the history of the legal system and the Supreme Court in the 70s, it is a deliberate choice to prioritize the wealthy. It is a deliberate choice to prioritize white and cis straight people, and it is a deliberate choice to condition rights upon wealth. The Supreme Court was extremely open about that, and a whole series of cases across the 70s in multiple different areas shows that for a long time, the court system has been aware of these problems and has chosen to not only not do anything about them, but embrace them further. For example, in the 1970s, there were a series of challenges to the bar exam on the grounds, and this has been proven over and over again, that the bar exam is nothing more than a racist and ableist gatekeeping measure. There has never been any statistically proven link between your ability to pass the bar exam and your ability to practice law. And I say this as somebody who passed the bar exam the first time that she took the bar exam. So this is not sour grapes because I couldn't pass the bar exam. I did. This is a fact. There is no link whatsoever between the bar exam and your ability to practice law. All the bar exam does is it prevents poor people and people of color from becoming lawyers. And let me explain how. Because the bar exam does not test most of what you learn the second and third year of law school, which means that unless you are able to, in addition to your caseload and the job that you probably have to get through law school, unless you have time to study your all of your first year stuff and the plenty of stuff you didn't cover in law school that's on the bar exam, you have to take a second course that is full time after law school before you graduate in order to prepare for the bar exam. And guess who can't afford to take the time off or to buy that course, which routinely is $5,000 to $10,000.
Wow.
And so there has been for a long time a mismatch between the demographics of the people who graduate law school and the demographics of the people who take, let alone pass, the bar exam. And so in 1970, I believe it was 1976, a group of Black students sued the state of South Carolina saying that the bar exam was racist. And they had a series of experts testifying that the racial gaps in passage rates were the result of the test itself and how it was set up. And they even had evidence going back to when the bar exam was created about how the bar exam was created for that express purpose, because before Reconstruction, there was no bar exam. It wasn't until Black people were allowed to become lawyers that all of a sudden the bar exam popped into being.
Right.
And the Court of Appeals in that case concluded, if lawyers were subject to civil rights law, yes, this would be a violation, but the legal field is not, therefore it isn't.
Wow.
What?
So, like, yes, it's completely discriminatory, but the legal field has no requirement to not be discriminatory.
That's correct.
That interesting.
And I'm writing a book about how there are disparities in the legal field, and they exist by design, not by effect. From eviction case outcomes to the bar exam to the rules of procedure themselves. So one thing that my clients are always blown away by is how little the actual proceedings resemble what you see on television with Law and Order or CSI. First of all, half the science you see on these shows does not exist. And second, what you see, because on Law and Order, they have you believe, you go up, you make this eloquent argument, the guilty people are always convicted. You can do discovery during the trial. You just find things out during the trial. That's not how it works. In reality, the legal system doesn't care about truth so much or what's right so much. It's about following the rules and meeting deadlines. And we have more procedural rules than any other system in the world, even more, like a significant multiple more than even the other British Commonwealth countries like Canada or Australia or the United Kingdom. They have a lot of procedural rules by the standards of the rest of the world. And British lawyers cannot practice here because they cannot fathom the number of procedural rules that we have, because there are just so many. But the reason that we have so many procedural rules is a guy named Christopher Columbus Langdell, who in the late 19th century decided that the law needed to be a science. And the best way to turn the law into a science was through a series of procedural rules. In reality, the procedural rules are just there as gatekeeping measures. So essentially, what you do is you make the legal system incredibly opaque by saying, here, you have to follow the rules, pro se litigant, pro se meaning you represent yourself. You have to follow the rules. Here's the 1,000 or so rules of evidence. Here's the 1,000 or so rules of procedure. Here's the 1,000 or so local rules. And here's the 1,000 or so different standing orders you have to follow. And then say, oh, and by the way, you will be held to the same standard as a lawyer if you can't learn all this. That's why people need lawyers. People don't need lawyers because lawyers are smarter than they are, or better than they are, or better thinkers. Lawyers the reason people need lawyers is because lawyers know all the rules of procedure. And trying to navigate this without that is like trying to do surgery on yourself. It's not that a lawyer is going to be able to argue your life better than you will. It's that the system is designed to make you need a lawyer because Christopher Columbus Langdell wanted it that way.
Yeah.
Wow.
That was a really, really interesting history that
I have to say outlined. I have to say that was perhaps one of the most radicalizing 45 minutes I've ever listened to in my life.
Yeah.
And I've listened to a lot of very radicalizing things recently.
It is frightening how, what once you really dive into the history, it is frightening how much of what we think of as effects of the legal system aren't just effects, but are, no, we made a conscious choice to do it this way. We knew what the consequences would be, and it wasn't that we did it anyway. It was that we said, oh, no, that's what we want, and then did it. Right. There's, for example, and I apologize if I'm prattling or talking your ear off. Please feel free to stop me at any time.
This is incredibly fascinating, honestly.
It is, yeah.
During the housing crisis, and without getting too much into the weeds of what caused the housing crisis, it will suffice to say that thanks to loan securitization, which is essentially banks were chopping up loans, selling pieces of loans, banks couldn't keep track of who owned which loan. So when it came time to file foreclosures, you had multiple banks filing foreclosures for the same loan on the same property, even against people who thought they were current because they had been paying a completely different bank. Once had somebody come into my office because there were six different banks foreclosing on the same loan, and they were current on their payments to a seventh. So,
wow.
What did the state of Illinois do? Well, the state of Illinois had a couple of choices. They could have followed traditional contract law, which says you have to prove you're a party to this contract if you're going to enforce the contract. But that would have meant thousands of banks walking away from foreclosure cases empty-handed, because if six different banks claim to own a contract, clearly five of them can't prove that they own the property. So instead what they did was they changed the rules to allow for what's called a blank assignment to be attached to the complaint. So now it's the job of the homeowner to prove that the bank doesn't own the loan.
Oh my God.
Holy shit.
That's
So and the reason I tell people this is there is a belief by some lawyers that the system does work. Mm-hmm. And I agree the system works. But they and I agree on exactly what that working is. There are those lawyers who believe that the system works and that all things being equal, it will produce a good result. I think that a good result from the system is possible when it is allowed to do so. And I think the Warren Court is a good example of that. But the problem is that we're coming up now on, it's 50 years, 50 some odd years since the end of the Warren Court. And what has happened in that time is the Federalist Society has essentially taken over the judiciary. And the downside of the Warren Court was the ability to do good was only because of mechanisms that were created to allow the judiciary to do harm.
Yeah. Right.
And so ironically, the Warren Court wasn't an example of the system working. It was an example of the system being used against its design to help people. The problem is that the system as we have it today is working as designed. And that is the most terrifying thing of all.
Yeah.
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 Can you quickly define for people what the Federalist Society is?
Absolutely. The Federalist Society is quite honestly nothing less than the most dangerous organization in the United States.
Wow.
After the Warren Court, when Earl Warren, the Chief Justice, had these really grand ideas of, you know, maybe we should try equality. Could be fun. And passed, seriously, in those 15 years, there was more good jurisprudence out of the Supreme Court than in the entire period of American history before or since. It is not an exaggeration. It is not hyperbole. If you just go to the Wikipedia page on the Warren Court and you see that cases like Brandenburg versus Ohio, New York Times versus Sullivan, Loving versus Virginia, all of the important rights that people take for granted are the Warren Court. Like, there were no Miranda rights before the Warren Court. There was a prosecutor has to tell you, you have a right to remain silent before the Warren Court. There was no interracial marriage before the Warren Court. That this is, and by no interracial marriage, I mean, there was no constitutional rights to it. So it was Griswold versus Connecticut was the Warren Court. That was the right to contraception. So the Warren Court pulled the United States kicking and screaming into the 20th century. The Federalist Society was formed as a direct backlash to that. The idea that Warren was what is known as an activist judge. You've probably heard that phrase before.
Yeah.
And that justices and judges need to be umpires who just call balls and strikes. In other words, you just say what the law is based on the original intent, because Warren was not an originalist. Warren believed very much in a living constitution and a constitution that changed with the times. And Warren was there. In fact, Warren in Brown v. Board, and this is interesting because in most textbooks, this part gets taken out of the excerpts. Warren found in Brown v. Board a right to a free education through college.
Wow.
Wow.
And then in San Antonio, a decade and a half later, that got basically overruled without explicitly saying we're overruling Brown v. Board. And the dissents to San Antonio all talk about, hey, you're basically overruling Brown v. Board, because Brown v. Board wasn't just about integration. It was also the most important right of any citizen is that of an education. So what ends up happening is the Federalist Society is formed to build a pipeline for conservatives to become lawyers and then judges. Sandra Day O'Connor, the former Supreme Court Justice, used to say that the most important and most powerful person in America isn't on the Supreme Court and isn't in Congress, it's a trial court judge. And the reason is that your average trial court has between 500 and 800 cases at any given time. Most of them will never be appealed. And what that judge says is law for the people in front of them. And whoever controls the judiciary controls all the people in front of them. So that is what the Federalist Society set out to do. And it is now so ubiquitous on law school campuses that essentially the first club you're invited to join is the Federalist Society. And they help, they do things like help you pay for your bar exam prep and have all of these moot court things. And it's very welcoming, and they don't overtly sell the agenda until after you join. When then they start selling originalism and the intent of the founders, blah, blah, blah. But to put it this way, all six conservatives on the Supreme Court were members. And the worst part is that because there is no counterweight on the left of any kind, and the Federalist Society's influence is so outside, liberals end up joining too. Yeah. And that's how you end up with Elena Kagan. So the problem is that the Federalist Society has this worldview, this vision of a judiciary that is restrained and doesn't do what Warren did, and it returns to the Lochner era. And by the Lochner era, I mean the Supreme Court in the 1920s. Before anybody had ever heard of Earl Warren, at a time when the Supreme Court was about to strike down FDR's New Deal as unconstitutional. Now, what's truly frightening about the Federalist Society is that they basically prepare lists. So every Supreme Court justice that Trump appointed was from a list prepared for him by the Federalist Society.
Oh, wow.
They have the, yeah. And it's been an open secret for years that if you want to be a, if you want to be a judge in a state that is even a little bit right of center, you have to be a member. And they have all the money. Sheldon Whitehouse, the senator, I think from Rhode Island, to his credit, has been screaming about this for a long time. Nobody listens. But he's been screaming about the effect of the Federalist Society on the judiciary for years. And how essentially they have turned money into the controller of the judiciary because they control all the money. Put it a different way. Most trial judges in the United States are elected. And long before Citizens United was a thing, that meant that judges could take campaign contributions from the litigants in front of them.
Wow.
So now you, so, and it got so bad that in the 2000s, there was a famous Supreme Court case that came out of the Supreme Court of West Virginia, where a coal baron made a massive donation to a West Virginia Supreme Court election. That election put that justice over the top, who then promptly ruled in favor of the coal baron at a case in front of him.
Oh, yeah. That's how we do it.
Yeah.
So, long before we were talking about, and even to this day, people talk about the impact of money on Congress, money on state legislatures. Nobody talked about the effect of money on judges. And if you look at the, take eviction judges, for example. Look who donates to their campaigns.
Yeah.
And the problem is there will always be a mismatch because it's not like tenants unions are going to be able to afford to donate lots of money to judge campaigns.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, it, wow. That's so, sorry. I'm actually just processing through all of that. That's.
Yeah. I want to kind of zoom out a little bit and try to get the big picture real quick. So we've covered a lot of stuff over the past half an hour, and I want to just kind of like, and of course I want you to help me with this, Cheryl, kind of like connect all of the pieces that we've been outlining. So there were laws going back to the 1400s, which allowed these landlords basically to evict people, and those laws have been modernized throughout the ages, and like something that's almost a tired point by now is that capitalism is just feudalism with extra steps. We have a lot of holdovers from feudalism. We have our modern day coal barons and these captains of industry and whatnot. But like the courts are a class institution. They've always been a class institution. And that class tends to favor the ruling class, the class with the most money, because they have the money to invest in making sure their people end up in positions of power. During the Warren Commission, there was a lot of progressive change in the positive, in like a positive direction. We had what looked like segregation coming to an end. We had even the right to a free education as part of Brown v. Board of Education. But since then, there's been the Federalist Society, which is the society that basically indoctrinates you into believing in this idea that the Constitution is a fixed thing. And since the Constitution was written by wealthy landowners, it favors wealthy landowners. On top of all of this, there is a legal system which is just impenetrable and opaque to the average person because there's so many rules in just the process of doing any sort of legal proceeding or litigation that the average person needs to get a specialist which often costs a lot of money on top of the fees that it costs to go through court. Was that a pretty good summary?
It was the Warren Court, not the Warren Commission, but other than that, you are absolutely correct.
Okay, I misspoke. Thank you.
No, I just, because there was a Warren Commission, and I just wanted to
this up, that was the,
find the right thing.
That was the JFK Assassination Commission, isn't it? Was it not?
I got my Warrens mixed up.
Yes, exactly. And the Warren Court was a, the Warren Court was just the thing that, that it was just the Supreme Court that was where right. The Chief Justice was Earl Warren.
Right. Mm-hmm. I think that it's this the my response to this conversation so far, to learning what I've learned so far from you, Cheryl, is if I feel like it's underscoring something that I've kind of understood to be really terrible in our system for a long time now, both on a like knowledge level of just what I've learned about it, but also on a personal experience level. But what's really kind of been underscored in this conversation for me is just how by design this really is, and just how much the judiciary is used to enact oppression on people, that is sometimes very difficult to see and is not, it's very difficult to spotlight, I feel like.
Yeah.
Compared to things that a president does or things that Congress does.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like, and this, I think this kind of underscores, like something else we've been researching recently is Project 2025. And one of the key elements to Project 2025, is, I don't know, actually, Mason, do we want to go into this, like, into 2025, Project 2020?
We can briefly touch on it.
Yeah, like, I don't want to get too into the weeds on it right now, but, like, I don't know if you're familiar with it or not, Cheryl, mm-hmm. but just for everybody else, it's basically this, this plan that was produced by a right-wing think tank known as, I believe, the Heritage Foundation was the one that brought it mm-hmm. out. But it is the plan for the next Republican president, whoever that may be, and how they plan on using that presidency to basically enact a fascist takeover of the United States.
Yes. I was looking through the like intelligence community like section of Project 2025, and it's basically like they want the president to pick everybody important in the intelligence community off of this, like, basically pre-approved list. And they say that, like, this is to ensure that the picks are apolitical. This is to ensure that the right people are doing the job. But then at the end of the section, or the end of, like, the paragraph, they write, this is about taking care of the woke. So they kind of disguise it in this language of, like, we just want the best people doing the best job possible. But in reality, it is this this plan to basically get all of the liberals out of the intelligence service so they can really start cracking down. And right. it's a similar sort of situation with the Supreme Court, where it's entirely captured by conservative justices at this point, and they're ruling in a conservative way.
Right. And one of the other critical elements to Project 2025 is the replacement of every judge that they can get their hands on with judges that are pre-selected, basically. Judges that will fit a certain set of criterion that they have established.
Mm-hmm.
And they already have lists of lawyers that they are making right now to take these judicial positions that they have intended. They've stated intention of replacing. And so it's understanding how messed up this system really is, the judicial system really is, it makes it easier for me to understand why they're taking that particular tack.
Now, the interesting thing, and I don't mean to interrupt, the interesting thing about the Project 2025 is that it's based on what the Federalist Society already did with the courts. The problem, I think, and this is something, a discussion that I have with a lot of people on the political left pretty often. People who I greatly respect. There's this idea that we have to stay out of the courts because the judges are cops, lawyers are cops, just ACAB includes everybody in the legal system, just leave it alone. Here's the problem.
Yeah.
Those positions will be filled.
Yep.
And unlike, say, the presidency, where, let's be honest, it's not very likely that even a member of the squad is ever going to be president, let alone, you know, somebody who is a dyed-in-the-wool socialist, not going to happen. However, there are a lot more local prosecutor and judge positions than there are president positions. They're all locally elected, most run unopposed.
Yes.
And most of those candidates are picked by the Federalist Society, even down to the state trial court level judges, and then they just run unopposed because nobody runs against them. And this is something that the Federalist Society has understood for a very long time. And the problem is that it's not like you can just snap your fingers and pretend that the judiciary is not going to have an impact on people's lives. First of all, it is the most direct method of harm reduction I have ever seen. Because I'll tell you what, you can, and this is in no way to detract from the work that activists and organizers do, because it is vitally important and we need more of them. But if you want to keep a person from being homeless, winning their eviction case is a great way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to keep somebody from being homeless, being the judge who just refuses to sign any eviction orders is a better way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to dismantle the carceral state, winning your client's innocence is a great way to do it. And being the judge who refuses to sentence anyone to prison time is an even better way to do it. The reality is that the judiciary is the gatekeepers for the carceral state, for the school-to-prison pipeline, for the homelessness epidemic. The rise in rents is because there are so many evictions, because you can't raise rents for a new tenant if you can't get a new tenant. The courts are how all of this happens. And the only reason it has been able to happen is because the left has essentially ignored the courts for so long, and that is also because of Federalist Society propaganda. So, I understand that a lot of people look at this and say, this is really distasteful work. And honestly, as somebody who represents working class people, I understand where that belief comes from. But at the same time, you cannot dismantle a system unless you know how it works.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot defeat a system unless you know how it works. And unless somebody comes up with some great way to free everybody from the carceral state that does not involve the courts, and I would be all ears, but I can't think of it. The truth of the matter is, you need them. And what the Warren Court showed, if nothing else, is the ability of the judiciary to do massive good in a short time. And that's why the Federalist Society exists, to prevent that from happening again. It is, to this day, other than mass movements like we saw during the civil rights movement at the same time, the only effective mass movement for progress we have ever had. Like, there is a direct correlation between the amount of progress that we made, not that incrementalism is enough, but the only progress we have really ever made in a short time was during the Warren Court.
Yeah.
Because that filters down. Because once the Supreme Court says something, all the judges who want to be on the Supreme Court are now following that too, because a decision is binding on all courts below it. So there is a lot that can be done with the judiciary, and I would argue that the worst thing that the left ever did was just abandon it. Because, yes, there is, it is incredibly distasteful to be a part of the system, but also, like I said, nobody ever can opt out of it. And I think, at least, there is no difference between the work I do and somebody who is a doctor in the American healthcare system. Yes, the American healthcare system sucks. But the solution is not, okay, no one should be a doctor now.
Right.
The American legal system sucks, but the solution is not, nobody should be a lawyer now. It's, we need more lawyers who are going to change the system. Mm-hmm. And the worst part of my job is just, frankly, how damned lonely it can be being the only one of me.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I wish I had more to contribute to this conversation, because I am not super familiar on how the court system works. I don't think law is something I'm ever going to go into, but I definitely understand your perspective where it is important to engage with these systems as a citizen of your country. Because that's, like, we are still capable of doing harm reduction and enacting positive change. Like, I think you could almost make an analogy to it being like voting. Like, I have no faith in the electoral system to deliver any real meaningful results. I think we're going to get those results through other means. But I still vote in every, like, local election that I possibly can, because I would prefer it if the candidates who were backed by the teachers union, were staffing the school boards. I would prefer it if there were liberal, people in power in my state compared to reactionary conservative people in power in my state, because those are conditions that are easier to organize under, and I'm personally affected by a lot of the things that the reactionaries in power want to do. And a lot of my friends are affected as well. So it's worth engaging with the tools that we have at our disposal, like all of them, even if it's not like the coolest or flashiest way of going about it.
I will. And the thing about the courts is we know it works, because we have a proof of concept. Emma Goldman used to say that if voting changed anything, they'd make it illegal. But if you read Emma Goldman, she wasn't saying, no, you should never vote in anything. Mm-hmm. What she was saying is that you should always look at the people who aren't allowed to vote.
Yeah.
I think this is a similar kind of thing. If you want to know what can affect the most change, what can help people the most, you want to look at where reactionaries concentrate their power. And reactionaries have been concentrating their power in the courts for a very long time, which is why I think it is so clear that this is a place that the left needs to be organized. If the project of the Warren Court had been completed, because Warren's health did not allow him to stay on the court long enough to complete it, but if it had, the United States would have ended up with a nationwide right to housing and a nationwide right to education.
Mm-hmm.
That would not have fixed everything. But it's pretty clear that this would have been a better country.
Yeah.
And if you look at at the Warren Court as a model for what the judiciary has the power to do, that means that the Supreme Court could find a right to health care. Supreme Court could find a right to housing, because it's already done it.
True.
It's already done it. So I think there's a bit of a cut off my nose to spite my face mentality, I think, from too many people. We need to know how the courts work, and then we need to be able to recognize what an opportunity the courts present to make people's lives better. As you know, mm-hmm. at the end of the day, I understand that as much as I wish this wasn't the case, the truth is we're not going to see a society with true equality, let alone equity or justice, within my lifetime. And that sucks. But at the same time, I do think there are real opportunities to make people's lives better that are being neglected. And that's one of the things that really that upsets me, because there is so much opportunity for if not positive change, at the very least harm reduction. You know, there's the worst part about representing tenants who are facing eviction is how beautiful some of their homes are. And I'm not talking about the people who live in mansions or I'm talking about people who live in slums or ghettos and have turned those into the most beautiful homes imaginable, because that's what they've got. And they put paintings on the walls that they did themselves, or they make their own curtains because the place doesn't have doors, or they make their own candles to make the place smell nice. And they take pride in this. And at the end of the day, that's their home. Their home means something to them. And so it should to me too. And it should to everyone else. And that is why I do what I do, because everybody deserves a chance to have some control over their own story. And that is what the legal system does. It takes that control away from you. You can't tell your own story anymore. Someone else will dictate it. I don't know any better way of harm reduction than giving that person that control back, at least to the extent that I can.
Agreed.
No, I agree. And I think it's incumbent on us to take advantage of every systemic approach we have available to us, because, yes, I do think that if we start seeing a mass movement into the judiciary on the part of the left, that or at least an attempted one, that we'll start to see more systemic pressures start to prop up that make that more difficult, if not impossible. But the trick is that we have to force their hand to do that in the first place.
Yeah.
Yes. And the reality is, yes, it's not like you elect 10,000 liberal or leftist judges and all of a sudden everything's fixed. That's not
right. No, that's not right. That's not how this works. Right.
Every person that you keep out of a cage is a win. Every person that you keep from being homeless is a win. Every family you keep together is a win. And I would love to have a situation where I can be bringing lawsuits to establish rights to housing as opposed to trying to keep people from losing their housing. At least a recognition that there is more than this. We could move the direction, move the needle. And the reason I'm so passionate about this work is, frankly, because it can get very lonely when you're the only one doing it. And there are other people in other states who are doing a similar kind of work, but they are also few and far between. Like public defenders, the work that public defenders do, they are absolute heroes, and they do not get recognized as such. Prosecutors make 2, 3, 4 times as much as public defenders, have far less of a caseload, and public defenders simply are not funded by states. All those public defender fees I talked about before tend to go into a state's general fund, and most commonly are paid to police officers, which creates this wonderful incentive where a public defender, the money that is charged for the public defender defending a person goes to the arresting cop.
Oh, wow.
So it's stuff like that. Increasing budgets for public defenders is a little thing that could make a huge difference, because people talk about how public defenders do not return calls. Well, that's because they have 250 cases.
Yeah.
That's insane. It is not acceptable. It is it's the kind of thing where you look at the way we do things on purpose. Well, yes, because we're supposed to be doing it. For example, there's a judge in a suburb of Chicago who, whenever a defendant asks for a public defender, his response is, "We don't coddle criminals here."
Hmm. That's extremely fucked up.
Yes, yep. We sit here and we pride ourselves on having a system that's like about, you know, innocent until proven guilty. But yet in the eyes of so many people, when they're making decisions on what types of policies to support when it comes to this sort of thing, they just don't view it that way. They view everyone that is in the criminal justice system as a violent, horrible criminal who clearly is only in that position because of something they must have done wrong.
Yeah.
And the worst part is it extends to how inmates and incarcerated people are treated.
Yes.
Where prison labor is a $9 billion per year industry in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just in terms of profits. That's not total revenue. That's just profits. It's so bad that Colorado a few years ago passed a constitutional amendment banning forced prison labor. And the Colorado appellate court turned around and immediately said, no, that's not what the voters meant. I swear to God this is true, because they said clearly the voters did not to outlaw therapeutic forced labor.
What the hell is therapeutic forced labor?
And all I could think of was the sign over Auschwitz that said, work will set you free in German. Or for another example, Kamala Harris, when she was Attorney General of California, signed a series of briefs refusing to free inmates from prisons that were overcrowded, even after their sentences were complete and courts had ordered them released, because she said it would be bad for the firefighting season and she wouldn't have enough firefighters.
Holy shit.
Oh, I remember hearing about that. She
basically forced incarcerated people to go fight fires and risk their lives for no money to speak of, even after their sentences were completed by court order.
But these are just criminals who have no value to our society, you know. They're fighting our fires and whatnot. But what if they were like out? What if they were like at my local restaurant?
Right.
But kind of to go to your point, I represented somebody earlier this year who their sentence was completed. The jail would not release them. I got an order requiring their release, and the sheriff refused. Because they disagreed.
What the fuck?
And I was like,
that's how that works.
Their sentence is over. The judge confirms the sentence is over. Release my client. No.
Holy shit.
So they end up transferring my client to a unit infested with mold that had previously been deemed unfit for human habitation. And refused to let my client speak with me because they're like, well, we're not holding your client on criminal charges anymore, so clearly there's no need for them to speak with you.
That is terrifying.
Wow.
Because they thought that my client was still a danger. No matter that it didn't matter that the judge had ruled completely otherwise.
Wow.
So yeah, that is the carceral state. There is there is this belief that you serve your time, you get out, you're done. No. In reality, what happens is you serve your time. Maybe you get out, maybe you don't, because oftentimes the prison system will not actually release you. If they do release you, then you aren't able to get any housing and you can't get a job because criminal history is, for so many people, essentially a scarlet letter that prevents you from getting any access to credit or housing of any kind. But if you don't have those things, you go back to prison.
Mm-hmm.
The way, and just to give you an idea of the scope of the problem, and lots of people have written about the American carceral state, but the United States, I apologize, that is a parrot legal in the background. My wife and I have these two conures. We call them Tuvok and Catherine Janeway, and they are adorable, but they like to sometimes be loud at inopportune times.
Oh, that's okay.
The United States incarcerated, until recently, more people than China and North Korea combined.
Mm-hmm.
Or to put it a different way, if you would look at all people incarcerated by the United States has 1/4 of the world's prisoners, and we are 4% of the world's population. Or to put it a different way, if incarcerated people in the United States were their own state, it would be the 11th largest state in the country. The scope of how many people we lock up is so big that it's almost impossible to wrap your head around. And that does not include people in immigration detention, people in police lockups, who are sometimes there for lengthy periods of time, people who are on house arrest or other kinds of detention. And the even worse part is how many of them are locked up without actually being charged or convicted of a crime. One of the one of my personal heroes, a lawyer named Oleyemi Olorin, who she has a YouTube show and does some just brilliant writing on the carceral state. She has been covering an issue with Rikers in New York, Rikers Island, the fairly notorious jail, for some time now. Now, what's interesting about Rikers is they admitted earlier this year that over 80% of the inmates there have not been convicted of a crime and are there because they can't afford bail.
Yeah.
Now, in Illinois, we abolished cash bail earlier this year, which is great, because cash bail is basically just you're being held for being poor.
Yeah.
But the worst part of that was the number of judges who are just like, eh, I don't agree. And so you have everything from I'm not going to follow this law because I disagree with it, to my personal favorite, a judge downstate who simply said, well, since cash bail was abolished, that means I'll just lock up everyone.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of the problem. And it's why I think there is so much opportunity to make positive change within the system. Because the replacement level, to steal a baseball term, replacement level for a lot of these positions is so low that just getting there and being like, yeah, I think I'm just not going to send this person who stole this chicken because they were hungry, and that I'm not going to send them to prison because this is a bad use of taxpayer money, and nobody should go to a cage for being hungry. Just that would be an improvement. That's how low the bar is, and it's not an example I pulled out of thin air. I had a client who ended up being charged with a felony as a repeat offender for retail theft because he was homeless and stole a chicken. And it was a rotisserie chicken from a supermarket. And that is what he was charged with a felony for, because he hadn't eaten in a week.
Jesus.
Yeah.
The way I like the way that you framed it as crimes of poverty, because that is the entire basis of the carceral state. Which brings me back to eviction. The most common first arrest for a young black boy in the United States is a crime committed to pay his mother's rent.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Which is why, if you look at who opposes tenants' rights ordinances in the United States, and who pushes so-called crime-free ordinances, it's almost always for-profit prisons.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because for-profit prisons need bodies. Where do they get bodies? They get bodies from communities of color and poor people.
Exactly.
And in order to do that, they need to make sure there are lots of evictions. Because the biggest predictor of a future arrest or incarceration is the eviction of somebody's mother.
Mm. It really is horrifying. I have a story that I feel is kind of relevant. I'd actually be really interested in getting your take on this, if that's okay.
Absolutely.
Okay, so when I was like 18, I spent a night in jail for reasons that I'm not going to go into. But like, this was this was something that proved to me beyond any reasonable doubt that white privilege is real and I'm benefiting from it. So I was already in like the little jail cell at my like local police department. And I saw these two black boys come in. They were like 16 and 17 years old. I'm pretty sure they were brothers. And they had gotten arrested because they were on drugs and they broke into some rich dude's house. The first weird thing that happened was when the police were giving them the mental health questionnaire, they were asking them, like, have you ever suffered from mental illness? Are you depressed? And one of the kids said, yes, I've tried to kill myself. And one of the cops just screamed at him, don't you fuck with me. And the kid was like, no, I'm serious. I've actually tried to kill myself. And the cop just kind of like moved on and pretended like that didn't happen. The rest of that day passed without incident. I got like an hour of sleep. Before the judge in the morning. And when I went before the judge, they gave me 11 days in the holding center. And they set my bail at $200. My bail was made and I got to go home, thankfully. But these two black boys, they were both given 2 days in the holding center, giving them as little time as possible to seek legal representation. And their bails were set at $2,000 each by this white judge. And it was just, it was horrifying to watch because I knew that effectively these people's lives were going to be over and they were younger than I was. Like, I don't know what their circumstances were, so I'm not going to judge their decisions, but there's nothing that justifies taking these people's rights away and taking away their abilities to, like, live their lives as, like, human beings with the rest of us.
No, you're absolutely right. Yes, I dare say that race had a great deal to do with it. And no, that does not surprise me. I have seen it over and over again. So, to kind of explain this, that how this happens sort of on a larger scale. I mentioned earlier crime-free ordinances. They're an invention of a group of conservative, very racist and xenophobic organizations with the help of an Arizona sheriff named Joe Arpaio.
Oh, I've heard of this guy.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's a nightmare.
Yeah, bad person. Anyway, a crime-free ordinance is this new invention. There's over 100 municipalities in Illinois that have adopted them. They're all over the country. It basically says that any crime you commit is a violation of your lease and grounds for eviction. Which on its face sounds a little bit weird, but okay. And then you look at how crime is defined. And it's stuff like changing the character of the neighborhood. Or my personal favorite, making another person feel unsafe.
Huh.
Okay.
Or repeated use of police resources. Now, that last one has the effect of essentially penalizing black people, brown people, trans people, and victims of domestic abuse, because if you are stopped for driving or walking while black, or you're being beaten by your partner and they call the police, now you're getting evicted, which keeps happening over and over and over again. And it is proven that this has the effect of making areas whiter and straighter and more cis and essentially causing domestic abuse. That is proven. We know this happens. But municipalities love them because they talk about how calls to the police go down so much. The best part of these ordinances is how, after they're passed, as a general matter, arrests of people of color go up even more. Because now the police know that merely stopping someone for driving or walking while black can result in their eviction and removal from the community.
Yeah.
Wow.
So the reason I bring this up is what you witness, this sort of overt bias, is present at every level of the legal system and is by design. Because you see a lot of law review articles nowadays about implicit bias and the effects of implicit bias on judgeships and judges and sentences and stuff like that. There's a cliche that a hungry judge gives harsher sentences. It's statistically proven to be true. And so they act like racism is the same thing. It's not, because we pass laws that do this on purpose.
Right.
We do this on purpose. So the net result is more segregation, is more gentrification, is more incarceration on purpose. And then we talk about implicit bias. And I feel like it is important to differentiate between the two. Not because implicit bias is okay. It's not. But because implicit bias is something that you don't know you have, and you need to consciously work to negate it. But the legal system does not have an implicit bias. If it did, we'd have a much better legal system. The legal system has an extremely overt and deliberate bias. And I feel like discussing these kinds of disparities in the context of an implicit bias does a disservice to the people who are affected by it. Because a lot of this is not people are doing their best, but not aware of the biases that they have, or even people are just like, I'm not racist. I don't have a racist bone in my body. A lot of this is actually, no, I'm racist, and that's a good thing.
Yeah.
That, and that's the problem with a lot of how the system is currently constructed. There is not just a recognition of what is being done, but a glorification of it.
Exactly, yeah. And like we see that everywhere. We see that with the propaganda. We see that with the Thin Blue Line shit. Because like, what does the Thin Blue Line really mean? The Thin Blue Line became like popular during the 2020 uprisings. It had been a thing before that, but I really started seeing it more during the 2020 uprisings. And what does this effectively mean? This means that they support what the police are doing to racial minorities. This means that they support the prison industrial complex. This means that they support evictions and making sure that people become homeless so they can be shuffled into the prison industrial complex. And there's this overt, explicit bias which exists in the system, which reactionary racists really love to see in action.
Yes. Yes, that is absolutely correct.
Yeah. It's so fucked up.
Yeah.
Hey, everybody. We hope that you guys enjoyed this episode, but we are going to head out now because Cheryl is very busy and she has to get back to saving the world.
Yeah. Also, Jeremy sends his regrets. He had to disappear about halfway through there for family reasons.
Yeah. But yeah, thank you so much, Cheryl. Is there anything that you'd like to plug before we go?
Thank you so much for having me. I cannot plug anything besides just if you're interested about my work. My website is www.weikallaw.com, weikallaw.com. If you'd like to support my work, I have a Patreon. It is at patreon.com/weikallaw. And I am writing a book about the legal system, my experiences in it. It has more of the stories that we talked about today. As soon as I can find a publisher for it, it will be called Circus Courts, How Racism and Greed Poisoned American Justice and What You Can Do About It. And I will let you know when it is coming out. And lastly, I'm not sure when this is going to be airing, but if it is in the general vicinity of Thanksgiving or near Giving Tuesday, I would encourage anyone listening who has the ability to do so to donate to either the Native American Rights Fund, NARF, or the Palestine Children's Relief Fund, two organizations doing amazing work for Indigenous people. And I am a big believer that as a white settler myself, if you're going to be celebrating the Thanksgiving holiday, you owe some form of reparations. I donated to both organizations, and I would encourage anyone listening to do as well.
Yeah, that's awesome. And we'll link those organizations in like the pinned comment as well.
Right, as well as your website and Patreon and so
forth. Yeah, definitely. So yeah, once again, thank you so much for coming on. And this has been Blood, Sweat, and Strife. We'll see everybody next time.
Goodbye, everyone.
Goodbye.